Welcome. You're listening to a recording provided for the use of the blind and print impaired. Materials of items read on AIRS LA are the copyright property of the original authors and publishers. No unauthorized use or duplication is permitted. Today's articles are from the June 2026 edition. The Burger King. One man's mission to honor the makers of an American classic. When people ask me for a short list of places to eat in Memphis, I always include Dyer's Burgers on Beale Street, which was founded by Elmer Doc Dyer back in 1912. They're famous for thin, crispy, well-seasoned burgers that are deep-fried in the same grease they've been using for more than 100 years. The legend goes that an employee forgot to change the grease in the skillet one night, and the next day customers raved about how good the burgers were, so they've been straining and reusing it ever since. But don't worry, they keep it very clean. When the restaurant had to move to a new location, they paraded the magic grease down Beale Street with a police escort. I first wandered into Dyer's in high school, probably on a night when I shouldn't have been downtown. But I didn't give the place much thought until my friend George Motz wrote about it. George is a hamburger fanatic, a scholar, really, who's been examining local and regional varieties for more than 20 years. In 2004, he made a documentary called Hamburger America that profiled 8 burger joints with distinctive takes on what he considers an American art form. The film opens with Dyer's Burgers, which he discovered on a trip through Memphis back in college. I came to understand that this was, in fact, the original way for making a hamburger. He told me recently on the Biscuits and Jam podcast, at one time, all hamburgers were made in pans for collecting grease. Dyer's is one of those places that still do it the same old way. In the years since that film came out, George has hosted Burgerland, a show on the Travel Channel, written the book Hamburger America, which covers 220 joints around the country, and even opened his own critically acclaimed restaurant, also called Hamburger America, in New York City. It sounds like an unhealthy fixation, not to mention the cholesterol implications. But what really drives George is telling the wonderful stories behind these iconic establishments. As he writes in Hamburger Heroes, fortunately for all lovers of the classic burger, there is no shortage of places that have survived decades and seem entirely unaffected by time or trends. These are the spots we need to appreciate. As our team began talking about the 250th anniversary of this country, we wanted to celebrate some businesses that have endured, plus the families who keep them going every day. There's a guide to some of the best catfish cabins, those timeless eateries full of charm and taxidermy, and Pulitzer Prize-winning writer John Archibald shares a tribute to the Birmingham hot dog and the locals behind it. Most of these are mom-and-pop operations that have been around for decades, serving affordable food to a dedicated fan base who keep coming back for a reason. There are plenty of fancy restaurants to try these days, and we're grateful for those too. But let's not forget about the people who feed our souls as well as our communities. Get yourself a hamburger, a hot dog, or a plate of catfish, and have a very happy 4th of July. Sid Evans, Editor-in-Chief. In season, what we're loving, sharing, and celebrating. Let's grow. Jones Valley Teaching Farm is showing young people the power of food and sharing lessons that can last a lifetime. By Cameron Bell. Driving along I-20 through downtown Birmingham, you might be surprised to find a 3-acre city block of gardens, something that feels out of place against the urban skyline. Neatly planted plots and raised beds grow tall with rows of seasonal produce and blooms. Peach trees sag with ripe fruit, and eager students are hands-on in the fields. This is Jones Valley Teaching Farm, JVTF, where food and education form the foundation and empowering young people is the mission. Jones Valley really raised me. It was like my safe haven, says Sean Mack, the farm's education product manager. I grew up in a very tough neighborhood, and home was not a good place, so this felt like an outlet. When I went there as a student, I felt free, empowered, and curious. I felt all of these good things, so I just kept going. Mac's story with the nonprofit may be unique, but her sentiment and the impact the organization had on her isn't. What began in 2002 as an urban farm in the city's Southside area has grown into a Birmingham changemaker, providing access to healthy food in underserved neighborhoods and beyond. In 2007, the Downtown Farm and Center for Food Education were established, and the initiative has since expanded to include 8 teaching farms on the campuses of elementary, middle, and high schools, where instructors collaborate with teachers to connect classroom lessons to farm and culinary activities. In 2025, JVTF reached more than 5,000 students, supported 32 community gardens, installed hydroponic farming systems in 8 city schools, and distributed nearly 20,000 pounds of free produce from their 2 farm stands, one of which is at the Woodlawn High School Teaching Farm, where Mac first encountered JVTF 10 years ago. From student to steward, Mac was sitting in literature class when she was approached about helping build the school's teaching farm. At the time, the plot was no more than dirt and a dream in an area of the city that was considered a food desert. I remember them asking me about who I was, what my goals and interests were, and telling me about this idea and how it was going to do great things in the community, she recalled. She'd never grown anything, but a few months later, Mac found herself alongside a few classmates raising awareness for the project. And in the spring of 2016, the 2-acre Woodlawn High School teaching farm officially opened. I had no interest in getting dirty, but I tucked my dress pants in some boots and was out there farming. It was a whole new world, but once I started, I began to love it, she says. I remember the first time I put a seed in the ground. We just waited. We watered it and made sure it had plenty of sunlight and were out there weeding. Next thing we knew, we had a farm full of vegetables. These were things I had never seen. To have these skills and to be able to teach other people felt very empowering. Her story has been intertwined with JVTF ever since. Mac worked as one of the organization's first paid student interns, and then as a full-time instructor at her former middle school. Now, in her current role, she oversees field trips and programming for Camp Grow, which draws kids from across the region for farm, science, art, and culinary activities. Mac's path is exactly what the nonprofit hopes to enable for students who participate. Being part of Jones Valley means having a community that wants to see you grow. One that not only loves young people, but that also listens to them and is on their team. A community that gives them a voice and a say in how organizations like us operate, she says. The glory of okra. Few dishes have so much history and flavor. By Alana Alhatlani. Countless iterations of okra soup exist across the South, but its origins are frequently traced to Mary Randolph, author of The Virginia Housewife, which is considered to be the first American regional cookbook. Her recipe starts with 2 double handfuls of young okra that are sliced thin and simmered with onions. Relying on the sun to serve as her kitchen timer, she calls for those vegetables to cook from early in the morning until noon when lima beans join the pot. Eventually, tomatoes and summer squash are added, plus a jumble of proteins, including a fowl or knuckle of veal, a bit of bacon or pork. At the end, it's thickened with a roux and served simply over rice. But Randolph couldn't take all the credit. Okra soup is ultimately a dish from West and Central Africa that goes back centuries and has changed over time to fit the flavors of different southern locales, says culinary historian Michael W. Twitty. As with many southern women of her time, Randolph's recipes were heavily influenced by uncredited enslaved cooks. Okra came to the United States with those cooks via the transatlantic slave route and served as a link to their African heritage. It was a staple in their personal gardens and was often used as a natural thickener for soups and stews. Our version highlights summer produce and skips the meat, letting the okra shine in all its glory. Okra soup. Active 20 minutes. Total 50 minutes. Cut kernels from 2 ears of sweet corn. Reserve the cobs. Heat 1 tablespoon olive oil in a large Dutch oven over medium. Add 1 chopped yellow onion and 1 chopped green bell pepper. Cook, stirring occasionally until softened, about 8 minutes. Stir in 4 teaspoons all-purpose seasoning, such as Kinder's, 1 tablespoon minced garlic, 3 teaspoons smoked paprika, and 1/2 teaspoon black pepper. Cook, stirring often until the garlic is aromatic and lightly toasted, about 1 to 2 minutes. Add 6 cups vegetable broth, 1 15-ounce can diced tomatoes, undrained, 1 15-ounce can small red beans, drained and rinsed, 5 thyme sprigs, 1 fresh bay leaf, and reserved corn kernels and cobs. Bring to a boil over medium-high. Reduce the heat to low and simmer uncovered and stirring occasionally until flavors meld, about 20 minutes. Add 12 ounces fresh okra, trimmed and sliced, 1/2 inch thick. Cook, stirring occasionally until the okra is tender, about 10 minutes. Discard the corn cobs, bay leaf, and thyme sprigs, then garnish with thyme leaves. We have come to the end of our program. I'm Joyce Davis, and I will be back soon.